Always going to. Great. Thank you. And who put the recording on, Bonnie or Amira?
I did.
I did. Amira did? Okay. here's okay. So my wife is here, my daughter is here. Very nice. Okay.
Come here, I need your
So
help.
let us begin. As you know, this is 6 years since Alan passed away. He was such an important person for so many people. As everybody knows, that knows me, that Alan and I first met when we were 14 years old. And there was never a time that he wasn't part of my life. So not having him has been a tremendous loss. And we started this little tradition of having a teaching session in his memory. And part of that is for obvious reasons, because Alan was a teacher for his entire career. He taught at University of Maryland, he taught at Brandeis, and for the last part of his career, he taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and there he was a colleague of mine and many other people that people on this call know. But the other reason why we started this tradition is that Alan was one of the early members of Minyan Ma'at. Every Shabbat, he sat next to me. It was a lot of entertainment to schmooze with him during davening. And one of the things a role that Alan took on in Minyan Ma'at was to organize a number of study sessions that were sprinkled throughout the year, and some of which he led, and others of which he recruited people to do from within the Minyan community. And we thought, the leadership of the Minyan thought, and with my suggestion, that we should honor his memory by having a study session around topics that he would be interested in. And we've invited people to lead these sessions over the years who have been connected to Alan, either as friends or colleagues, or in this case, tonight, with Saul as a former student. And I think that Alan would have been amazingly pleased to have a former student lead this. And I know that Susanna and Amira and Avital were delighted that Saul agreed to do this. And Saul agreed. I sent him an email and I asked him if he would consider doing it. And I think I got a response about 30 minutes later, an enthusiastic response. So Saul is associate professor of Yiddish literature at Harvard. He's the author of a book called Jewish American Writing and World Literature, Maybe to Millions, Maybe to Nobody, a terrific title published by Oxford. He is a founding editor of the online Yiddish studies journal called In Geveb, which I peruse often. And he's working on a lot of very interesting projects right now, particularly related to translation, as well as looking at popular forms of Yiddish literature that have largely been not been studied by academic scholars. So we're delighted to have Saul here. Now, I distributed the text with an email blast this morning, and I left out the fact that all of the translations here are by Saul, and I'm going to put into the chat a link, which I will do in 1 second, to the text if you didn't receive my email and you want to see a copy of the material. I think I could also share my screen, but I think that this is maybe a little better way to go. And hold on one sec. Let me get back here. And now in the chat, you can find a link if you're interested in getting a text like that. So, Saul, without further ado, we're going to have Saul teach. And then afterward, we're going to have some time for people to offer their recollections of Alan. And a couple of people I know are going to speak, and then the floor will be open. And I know that's something that the family really values very much. So I will say, take it away, Saul.
So Barry, what's my time? Where do you want? When do you want me to go to?
I would say think of 50 minutes, 5-0.
Okay, great.
Yep.
So thank you, everyone. Thank you to Minyan Ma'at for having me. Let me join you in remembering and honoring Alan. Alan was a very dear teacher and mentor to me, not just because of the support he gave me as a student, you know, commenting and on all my work and giving me great advice through all of my academic career, but also he was a dear teacher and mentor because he made it all such a very living thing. It was something done in community. It was something done together, both the grand book project and also, you know, a big conference. This was something that brought lots of people together, but also, you know, it was a very quiet and very important meeting in his office late afternoon, casually to go over things. So it was a living thing. And that's what made him such a dear teacher and mentor to me. But what made this feeling of a living and learning together all the more powerful for me is because it had a different longevity than what we usually expect out of a teacher-student relationship. Often in the academy, the people we look up to, perhaps unfortunately, are people we read first and then meet afterwards. So it's one of the reasons the academy is such a strange place socially sometimes, because sometimes you struggle to figure out what the gap might be between something we've read of somebody and what they actually are as a person. Our books are not ourselves. We aren't our books, but our books are also part of us. So it can get kind of messy that way. Just as Alan, as we can read Alan through his books, but that's not all of Alan. In any case, with Alan, I didn't necessarily have this problem, or not exactly, because Alan was someone I knew from a very young age, before I had read anything that he had written, before I really knew what scholarship was. As many of you know, Alan is from Worcester, Massachusetts. That's my hometown. His parents and my grandparents were very close friends through Beth Israel, the Conservative Synagogue in Worcester. And Alan was the same age as my father. They grew up together. And as my father tells it, they were prose door rivals. And though I can't say who conjugated hufal verbs better than the other, Alan was USY president, and my father, by his own preference, was not. That being said, they received similar educations and were taught the value of the Hebrew language in particular. Their schooling took place in what I sometimes call the ruins of American Hebraism, though it was a ruins that was very productive for lots of people, especially in education. And they were taught by very ardent teachers to value Hebrew almost above all else, or certainly as one of the supreme, as a supreme Jewish value. And so, you know, for instance, in our own family, the Evan Shoshan dictionary, a very important Hebrew dictionary, is probably as much a holy book as a Siddur or any other Sefer Kodesh, certainly much more consulted, at least in my childhood, than many other holy books. So later, when Alan, now a professor of Hebrew literature, must have been when he was in Brandeis, would come to visit his parents in Worcester, and I would see him either at Shul or he'd stop by to visit my parents, I would assume that he carried some of that Hebraist legacy with him, and a legacy that I also felt some kind of affinity for. And he had the credentials for it, of course. Here was a professor of Hebrew literature. In my mind, if a good Hebraist, that was the highest that one could ever reach as an Hebraist. Not that I knew, say, as a preteen, what it meant to be Hebraist or to be a professor for that matter. Because for me, Hebraism and Hebrew College of Boston, these were mythical places to me more than they were practical things. This was a vocation, a way of life rather than a mere profession. So just a little bit of family history around that. So my Zadie, who would go on to become a dentist, was first a Hebrew teacher, trained at Hebrew Teachers College. And later he would mostly speak with us, his grandchildren, in that early 20th century Hebrew, rather than his own native Yiddish or his immigrant inflected English. And my own father, a Prose Dor graduate, of course, and a double degree holder at BU and Hebrew College, would go on to support himself in graduate school by teaching at Hebrew College again. He happened to fall in love with one of his students, and my mother and father got married at Hebrew College. So Hebraism and the study of Hebrew and Hebrew literature were never abstract things for me. They were the most familial and most intimate things, while also being world-shaping. I would not exist without Hebraism in some really fundamental way. So when I met Alan later as a professor of all this mythical and very personal stuff, I couldn't help but feel an immediate reverence and also affection for all that he might represent. Now, this was most likely more my overactive imagination than anything, any real evaluation of Alan, his profession, or of Hebrew literature. But I think something in Alan's quiet temperament, his intellectual verve, combined with subtle warmth and kindness, lined up with what I had conjured in my mind, what this whole world might be. So when on one of these visits, I don't know, I must have been in high school or maybe a little bit older, I'm not sure, and I was showing already an interest in literature, when Alan suggested that I might think about studying all of this stuff one day in graduate school, perhaps, well, this kind of small suggestion made as he was leaving, I think even, stayed lodged in my brain and is there to this day, that kind of suggestion from this kind of person. Now, this doesn't mean that things moved in a straight line or there were others along the way that pushed me in one direction or another, but it was certainly Alan who brought me to JTS for my doctorate work. I have no doubt that he had a hand in the generous scholarship that helped me dedicate so much time to my studies. And when I arrived at JTS for my PhD work, I was so lucky to receive the kind of attention that graduate students dream of. So many of my peers, and I'm spilling more dirt about the academy, I don't apologize for it. So many of my peers struggle so much with their advisors. Alan and David Ruskies, as my guides, I was treated immediately as someone who had something to contribute to what was going on without the need for a battle of egos. Just to give you an example, I remember at my oral exams, this is the end of my second year at JTS, Alan stopped the exam in the middle and he said, now I'm going to act like a belligerent academic and I'm going to ask you a series of needlessly hard questions. I'm going to cut you off several times just to give you a sense of what it'd be like to really be out in the academic world. And he did an admirable impression of this kind of scholar, but at the moment, it didn't really faze me very much. I was prepared for my exam, so I was ready for it in some way. But I think I knew that behind even this performance, there was much that same kind of care behind it from him. I knew that he wanted to engage with me, that he was inviting me, even in this act, to participate in the creativity and rigorous scholarship that was part of this world. He wanted it to make it possible for me to be part of that community. Now, we didn't see eye to eye on everything, most importantly about Hebrew. I came to JTS already ready to focus for the most part on Yiddish. I just completed a master's in Hebrew literature at Hebrew University after all, but Alan very much wanted me to continue working on Hebrew. Even so, as I circled around a dissertation topic, I ended up wanting to write about Yiddish writers in America, and Hebrew didn't really fit into that work. But he would continue to implore me to, this model that you're coming up with regard to Yiddish writers, see how it works in Hebrew, or maybe later reserve time in your writing schedule. You can write about some Israeli writers along the same avenues. And I think in our conversations, he sometimes played this up as he wanted me to look the most attractive on the job market, right? That I could do both Yiddish and Hebrew. He wanted me to be a more rounded scholar in that way. But I think it also had to do with some of his larger concerns about what he imagined the best kind of learning about Jewish civilization would be. He would often speak in his writing, but also elsewhere, about the sense that Hebrew enabled an access to deep structures of tradition, Jewish tradition and knowledge, stretching across the language's long and varied history up to the present moment. But I think even beyond that, I think the invitation to Hebrew, or imploring me to do more Hebrew, was a gesture of connection, of a wanting to work together, cultivating shared thinking. It was a kind of intimacy, bringing me back again to those both mythical and very, very deeply personal moments that I had with Hebrew. And so I'm very grateful for this question that he kept asking me, what about Hebrew? Not as something abstract, but again, as that mythical and personal thing. And they're questions that still animate me today, and lead to so many others. So what does it mean to have Hebrew today as a Jewish person living in the US, having long ago decided that Israel wasn't a place for me? What does it mean, as Alan put it, to be a near native in this language? I'll give you another example. When I was a student, starting as a student of Yiddish, and I began speaking the language with my bubby, my grandmother, Aleha Sholem, she would laugh and she would say, "Oh, Eret V'Yarov, he sounds like a rabbi when he speaks Yiddish," because her Yiddish, being a child of immigrants growing up in the U.S., her Yiddish was peppered with lots of English and Englishisms. You asked her, how do you say kitchen in Yiddish? She would say, oh, kitchen in Yiddish, right? But my Yiddish that I had learned in Israel as part of my academic studies, my Yiddish was very bookish, but also very deeply informed by that Hebraist education that I'd got. Hebrew was the language I was most fluent in, and Yiddish was a second language I came to. My Hebrew was inextricable from the intimacy I had. My Yiddish was inextricable from the intimacy I already had with the Hebrew language. So Hebrew haunts me in this way. And I don't mean that in a bad sense. It's a good kind of ghost, or a ghost that I want to figure out how to live with. Just like I want to figure out how I live with all the other languages I have. So what about Hebrew indeed? So what I want to do today, by Alan's invitation, is to think together a little bit about this language problem, this language imbalance, in a way that echoes Alan's own late reflections. As many of you know, Alan was working on Agnon those last years, but at the same time also doing a little bit more memoristic accounts of his study of Agnon, all of it involving Hebrew, of course, as well, and his own relationship to Hebrew. Many of those late essays, which are really brilliant essays about Hebrew, are really moving pieces that I return to often for guidance and inspiration. And so what I want to do with our time here is to look at a few texts and read and discuss around this circle of Hebrew and Yiddish together, for myself personally, but I think also a way for all of us to think about Hebrew and what its role is and how it works as a Jewish language or a language of Jewish life. What we'll do is we'll look at two poems in Yiddish about Hebrew and one poem in Hebrew about Yiddish to sort of get to some of these questions, all of them translated into English by me to round out this very complicated triangle of languages. And from this point forward, I think I'm hopeful that it'll be a bit more of a discussion. Hopefully people will be able to chime in, because I don't imagine that I'm the only one with this language problem, that people want to talk about or think about what Hebrew is to them, or what it means to speak in a Jewish way with Hebrew as part of it. So I hope by now people have figured out how to open up in some way, access the text or the series of texts we'll look at. And we'll start in Yiddish with a poem by an author very dear to me that I've written a lot about, a writer who I first started writing about in my dissertation that I wrote in part for Alan. And that's the writer Yankiv Glatstein. Yankiv Glatstein is an American Yiddish poet and critic and much else besides. He was a star of Yiddish modernism in the interwar period, and he became something of a I would describe him as a mournful prophetic bard in that post-war period, kind of person who wanted to pronounce about everything. And what we're going to read today is a poem that he wrote in the 1950s about language in the state of Israel. Okay, I have it here, so I don't have to do too much work. Do people want us to share a screen so people can see it on the screen as well? Or I'm seeing mixed responses. People say yes.
Please do.
Yes. Bear, would you be able to share it? Or I can do that too. Okay, I'm going to share screen. Okay. People see that okay? Great. So I will read in Yiddish and people can follow along in the English, just so we can hear a little bit of Yiddish anyway. The poem is Red zu mir Yiddish. Red zu mir Yiddish, mein Yiddish Land, und ich will zu dir reden Ivrit mimeile. Avrom mit Soren kommen mir an Kegen von der Mare Samachpele. Gott helf, seht der Bobische. Avrom geht schweigend die Gasse rüber. Nimm sich nicht zum Herzen, Jankele, sagt Zore. Er ist Maven Koldibir. Sie so doi eingenommen. A Manns will darf Jiddisch stummen, aber jedne von Jiddischkeit hat auch etwas was zu sagen. Sag ich dir, Gott helf, mein Kind, sollst mir all das Gutes vermogen. Gleib mir, Jankele, es wird kommende Zeit in Chamischosser Land von Rosenkäse und Feigen, als alle Ivrit-Kinder wollen aufhören, Jiddisch schweigen. Und als sie wollen sich zerreden, wollen sie, wird ein Naches sein zu hören, so wird geschehen, Jankele, mein Kind, a Schwur kann ich dir schweren. Der Seide Evrom von jener Seite Gas winkt zu mir und fochet mit der Verzähle. Oh, red zu mir Jiddisch, mein Jiddisch Land, und ich will zu dir reden, Ivrit, mein Egele. So, yes, this is a rather grumpy poem. Maybe it's not clear to everyone at the beginning, but Yankov Gladstein was sometimes a rather grumpy person, but that's okay. We like him anyways. So first, I want to focus on just those first two lines, which repeat at the end, which are so very important to figure out and very complicated. So, red zu mir Yiddish, mein Yiddish Land, und ich will zu dir reden Ivrit mimeile. So speak Yiddish to me, my Jewish land, and I will surely or naturally or in some automatic way speak Yiddish Hebrew to you. It almost seems like a conditional, right? If you speak Yiddish to me, then I will automatically in some way speak Hebrew to you. It's a kind of strange kind of deal that's going on. The other important thing to note here is the phrase Yiddish land, Jewish land, which could also be Yiddish land, my Yiddish land. Of course, the state of Israel is anything but a land of Yiddish. It is, of course, a land of Hebrew. But the big problem is, what is this word mimeile? What does it mean? How does it work? What's its function? Since it carries so much semantic weight. So does anyone know what the word mimeile means, or how, where does it come from, or what etymologically how it works? You can just, I can't really see anything because I'm still sharing screens, but if anyone wants to yell out something, they're welcome to.
Anyways, it means anyways, etule, mimeile, right?
Mimeile, well, is it, it is a Hebrew word, but it's first an Aramaic word before it becomes a Hebrew word. Anyone knows? There's some who argue that it's a misspelling of me'elav, so of itself. Right? There are those who disagree, but that's one way to think about it, mimeile. But it is in that way a very old Hebrew word, or a sort of rabbinic word, a word of rabbinic rhetoric, that also is very deeply Yiddish word. Right. So for those who don't know, Yiddish is a Germanic language of Eastern European Jewry that has within it all these other languages that come into it. It's called a fusion language. So it brings into this Germanic shell lots of Hebrew, of course, some Romance languages, Slavic languages, and other things. And so one of the things that makes Yiddish a Jewish language is in fact the insertion of these words and the insertion of Hebrew into Yiddish. So what does it mean to automatically speak Hebrew? It may be that all Yiddish speakers automatically speak Hebrew. Because if you're a Yiddish speaker, you are speaking Hebrew words all the time, like memele, which is in some ways both a Hebrew word and a Yiddish word, right? So if you were to speak some Yiddish to me, Jewish land, so Israel, speak to me in Yiddish, I'll answer you in Yiddish, but my Yiddish will actually have Hebrew in it, right? Or the opposite thing could be going on here, which is a little bit harder to understand. Speak in Hebrew to me, but I know that really the real Hebrew inside Hebrew, that which makes Hebrew a language that is communicable, is actually Yiddish. If you think back to how Hebrew, modern Hebrew comes about as a language, what actually makes up Hebrew? How is Hebrew built? It's certainly an old language of its own kind, but those who revived Hebrew, in order to make it legible, or how it happened naturally within the kibbutzim or elsewhere among the chalutzim, is that they ended up calking and importing into modern Hebrew tons of Yiddish, right? Memela is a word in modern Hebrew, not because they took it from Aramaic, but because it was already a word in their lexicon from the Yiddish that they spoke among the Eastern European Jews that made up early Hebrew speakers, of course. So there's a way in which when one speaks in Hebrew, behind one's modern Hebrew, there's also some Yiddish, mimele, right? There's already some Yiddish in your speech if you speak modern Israeli Hebrew, which is a hard thing to understand. But just to give you some examples that I'm sure a lot of the people on this call know some Hebrew, but if you were to say something like manishma, a very, like very richly idiomatic Hebrew way to ask someone how things are going, manishma, it is just a translation of the Yiddish vos herzer. This is just direct translation of that. Or all of your favorite hitpael verbs for those out there, hityashev, hitbayesh, these are all just translations of Yiddish verbs, shemenzich or zitzenzich, zitzich, right? Or any time a Hebrew speaker uses the words kimat or kvar, those are just calques of the Yiddish versions of very similar uses in Yiddish. So in that sense, one of the amazing things about this opening line, I know I'm spending a lot of time around it, but this opening line is it's so confusing, because who's speaking what language under what conditions, it's already all mixed up. Okay. That's the phrase. And then we get a little story, a little scene, a nice little dramatic scene in which our speaker, Yankele, that's Yankov Gladstein's name. So the Yankele in here is the speaker of the poem. And he's walking down the street in the state of Israel. And who does he run into? But Avram and Sarah, Abraham and Sarah, Avraham and Sarah, depending on who you are exactly. He sees them coming towards him. They've just come out of the Marat HaMachpelah. They've just come out of the cave. I guess, you know, Mashiach Zeiten, you know, they've come back from to life. And he greets them as you would, right? So the term Gott Helf, which means God help us, is actually also another way to say good afternoon. So he's greeting them as one should, one's grandparents. Yaakov, Yankov, is, of course, the grandchild of Abraham and Sarah. And what does Avram do? He crosses to the other side of the street. Now, someone greets him in Yiddish. He's offended because he's in the holy land of Israel, in which one speaks only in Hebrew, right? And so he goes, Schweigendick die Gasse rüber. He crosses the street silently. And Sarah, ever the comforter, talks to her grandson and says, don't take it to heart, Yankele. He understands every word. Now, this is, again, another flip, a brilliant Gladstein flip, which requires a little bit of explanation. So the phrase is, Ed is maven kol dibir. He understands every word you say. But this is a phrase in Yiddish, but has all Hebrew words in it, right? Ed is maven kol dibul. He understands every word. That's over here. For those that can look at the, I don't assume everyone knows Yiddish, but I think for the Hebrew, mevin kol dibur. Now, this is a phrase one would use in Eastern European setting, in which you suddenly come into contact with non-Jews, and you want to alert the other person that there's a non-Jew in the room, and you shouldn't speak too much Yiddish using the Germanic component, because the non-Jewish person can probably understand the Germanic component of Yiddish, but they don't understand all the sort of the Lashon Kodesh. They won't understand if you use only Hebrew words in your speech. So, you know, that's how you signal, be careful, there's a non-Jew in the room, right? So, but what's going on here? Sora says to Yankele, don't worry, it is Maven Kol Dibur, meaning he will understand Yiddish also, despite the fact that he's refusing to speak Yiddish, right? But it puts Avram in the status of being the non-Jew, right? He's the non-Jew you kind of have to be careful of, which is very strange because, right, Abraham is the very first Jew. So, you know, how does that work exactly? It is Maven Kol Dibur. It is a brilliant twist by Gladstein, right? Look at these Zionists, these Israelis who think that they're bringing back, that they are of the Jewish people and they're speaking the language of, you know, Jewish universality, Hebrew. But here we have, what that does is turns Avram into a non-Jew, right? Or something is wrong with this picture. There's a kind of a language problem in which Avram can't even speak like a Jew, even as he can only speak Hebrew. So that is another sort of twist that's going on. And so instead, right, if one of the things that's being said is there's something where men can't speak Yiddish anymore, because to be the new Jew or the new manly figure of the state of Israel, of Zionism, they have to take on this new Hebrew language, this new Israeli Hebrew. But on the other side of it, we still have the Bubby figure. We still have Sarah. A man needs to mute his Yiddish, but a Jewish woman can say something in Yiddish Teich, another word for the Yiddish language, Judeo-German. It's sort of the language of women's study in Yiddish. And she can say, I can say good health to you. It's no problem. I can greet you. I can be close to you. May all good things come to you. So this again gets to a certain stereotype that is supposed to divide Hebrew and Yiddish. Hebrew, the language of rabbinic and masculine learning, and Yiddish, the language of women and children, right? A more feminine language in some way. But then she gives us this vision. Believe me, young, a sort of messianic vision. Atzeit vet kumen in the Chamishasar land. Does anyone have an idea of what the 15 land may be? Why would Israel be called the 15 land? Any ideas? This stumped me for a little while, but I'd be curious if anyone came up with something. You can yell it out if you'd like. Chamishasar land. They give you a hint in the next line, the land of raisins and figs. When do we eat raisins and figs? At least in my Jewish education.
Tu B'Shvat.
Tu B'Shvat.
Tu, the 15th of Shvat. So the fifth land of Tu B'Shvat, basically. A time will come in this land of, you know, the sort of vision of sort of messianic vision of the fruits and the amazing fruits of the land of Israel. And then we get this very strange line. It's when all the Hebrew children will stop silencing Yiddish. As alle Ivrit Kinder willen aufhören Yiddish schweigen. What is a Hebrew child? Anyone have ideas what a Hebrew child might be?
Well, it's a child brought up speaking Hebrew, right?
Mm-hmm. And so there's something essentially Hebrew about them.
All the new generation of Israelis.
Right. So there's something native about their Hebrew. But what is the messianic vision? What's going to happen? They're not going to start speaking Yiddish, God forbid. Right. But what do they do? They stop silencing Yiddish. What would that look like?
They wouldn't shame people about it.
Okay. So you have something, there's no sort of public shaming involved. Yeah.
Accepting that.
Well, there's something
accepting the ghetto stuff that comes with Yiddish and the whole mentality.
You know,
yeah, so apparently they're, you know, they'll be stopping shaming the Yiddish mentality, perhaps. Right. But for
God's sake, they wouldn't destroy the linotype. They wouldn't destroy the Yiddish typography that was part of the language wars in the Yishuv.
Right. So stop. So if, for those who don't know, there was a history of persecution, of certain kinds of persecution, or certainly lack of support or cutting off support for Yiddish in the state of Israel, especially already in the 1950s. Not allowing certain kinds of performances, not allowing certain kind of printing or certain kinds of, there was still certain institutional support for Yiddish. It's very complicated. But certainly that's one thing that would happen from not silencing Yiddish. But the amazing thing for Glatchin is that he does want them to speak it, or at least this Sarah figure, Sarah, this our mother Sarah is imagining that when they start talking, and they surely will, oh, it will be a pleasure to hear. Naches zu hören. That's what will happen, young Kilimanjaro child, I swear to you. So they're stopping, when they stop silencing Yiddish, something will happen to their speech. Are they suddenly going to start speaking all in Yiddish, these Ivrit kinder?
Maybe it's not. Also a matter of allowing you to hear the Yiddish in Hebrew in the same way that the poem is making happen for us.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say next. The sense of one of the things Glatchin is trying to imagine is what would it be like if one could speak Hebrew, but allow the Yiddish to breathe underneath it in some way? How would that happen? What would that look like? And here it's put parodically as sort of some kind of strange thing that this mother Sarah up from the dead is imagining. And what is the pronouncement of our dear father Avraham about it? He's still on the other side of the street, right? He's not coming over from the other side of the street. He's still keeping his distance, and he's winking and waving a handkerchief. Hmm. Not a very bright imagination for the future of Yiddish in the state of Israel, but certainly I think as was just suggested, there's some kind of possibility or some kind of imagination that Gladstein's saying. The real life of Hebrew or the real Jewishness of Hebrew can only be unlocked. The real naches that might come out of Hebrew can only be unlocked through Yiddish, through some recourse to Yiddish. Now I can tell you, yes, go ahead.
Just what's the significance of Tu B'Shvat? Is there some mystical thing about that?
That I don't know, but that is the Zionist or one of the Zionist holidays that's sort of adopted from the Jewish calendar. Right. At least, you know, as I remember from my childhood, that's when we bought the leaves for the trees for JNF, right, was all associated with Tu B'Shvat. It is the sort of the holiday of that is both Jewish and rabbinic in some way, but has a very deep Zionist appropriation that was put onto it. I think more so than something like Hanukkah or Pesach, also associated mm-hmm. with lots of Zionist narratives around those holidays. You know, Tu B'Shvat for me, at least growing up in the Schechter day school that I went to in Worcester, was a Zionist holiday more than it had anything to do with ancient. Although we did have carobs, I think that was like an important lesson that we had. So yeah, it's not about. I think don't think it has a mystical connection, but really about sort of again sticking it to certain kinds of Israeli ideologies.
Saul, do you think that there's some? It's Anita Norwich.
Oh, hi.
I'm sorry, I can't, my camera's not on.
That's okay.
Do you think that there's some kind of, I don't know, I almost think of it as a kind of violence when he refers to Roshenkis und Feigen instead of Roshenkis mit Mandeln? That is, that there is this, you know, there's a clear connection in the Yiddish, which mm-hmm. has been so suppressed that it, even in the language of Hebrew, in the name of the language of Hebrew itself, he uses Ivrit and not Hebraish, which a mm-hmm. Yiddish speaker, you know, would more naturally use. There's a kind of violence in that suppression of the Yiddish that I think he's also pointing to.
Right. So just to explain what Anita was saying, Roshenkes mit Mandeln, the very famous Yiddish song or folk song of that point, but it's a song of the Yiddish theater that became a folk song, and he replaces the mandolin, the almonds, with feigen. The other thing to note about that is, this poem is very rich, a weisen a feig to somebody is to show them a fig is
to give them the finger.
Give them the finger, basically. Yes, exactly. So it's another way of him sticking it to the Hebrew language, or explaining that the Hebrew language is sticking it to Yiddish in a really violent way. Yeah. Yes, Ivrit is explicitly refers to a modern Israeli Hebrew rather than Hebraish or Loshon Kodesh, which refers to the much longer and broader history of the Hebrew language.
So, another Art Green here. Somewhere in the back of my mind, Yiddish is Mama Loshon, Hebraish is Tata Loshon.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to Avraham and Sarah, Tata Loshon versus Mama Loshon, and they're coming from Maris and Machpelah. Could that be a hint at the two languages, at the duality, at the doubled nature of the legacy they bear?
Yes, no, certainly. Sora is pro Yiddish, in as much as Avraham is not necessarily anti Yiddish, but he's a silencer of Yiddish, even if it's a language he understands. So yes, they represent, at least in Glatstein's construction here, the duality of Jewish languages. But she's the one who's, in this poem, is funnier, but also makes her less powerful, right? She's the one who doesn't have the power to go to the other side of the street. There's a kind of imbalance there. And she's the one who's left hoping for some kind of Yiddish revival or Yiddish continuation of some kind, as opposed to the kind of firm authority that Avraham, even in his kind of ridiculous, almost Charlie Chaplin-esque move, seems to have instead.
So
in the interest of time, yeah.
It's Carol Engel, and I just wanted to build on what Anita said. This issue of the warfare between the two languages, might that white handkerchief be the sign of truce?
Oh, interesting. I had not thought of that.
Stop fighting. You hold up a white flag.
Yeah, that could be there. It also sort of like softens the Avraham character as well, makes him a little bit feminine with the handkerchief as well. Both surrendering, but also in some way becoming more Sora-like, though he still stays on the other side of the street. So, well, I think we'll leave that as a question for now. I think, let me see where I am in my notes. Yes, it's sort of like the sense that Hebrew is a language that kind of overtakes everything, but that also there's a secret Yiddish or an underneath Yiddish that could in some way overcome this kind of power or bring some kind of Yiddish land into existence that would include both languages. And I want us to return back to that same, the word that ends the poem also, this idea of memeile, that it should happen of itself in some way, that there's something natural or necessary about this change that he's imagining. So with that in mind, now we'll move to a poem in Hebrew about Yiddish that will be less funny and a little bit more mournful. This is a poem by Avot Yishurun, also known as Yechiel Perlmutter. He was an important Israeli poet, born in 1904, died in 1992. He wasn't initially an important poet. He wasn't an Amichai Zach or Chaim Guri or any of these other Nathan Alterman. He wasn't part of those big generational shifts, though he did start publishing around the same time as all of them in the 1930s and 40s. But he was always a bit off compared to other Hebrew poets. He was a little bit more left, also with more pronounced interest in Palestinians, including in bringing Arabic into his poetry. And he also had a much clearer orientation towards the Eastern European past, whereas many Israeli writers sort of erased any kind of connection to Europe. He was very much interested in it. And a later group of Israeli poets, say in the 70s or 60s and 70s, sort of returned to having much more interest in him, and he became much more famous and more prominent in Israeli literature after that. And this is one of the very important poems in that process, a series of poems in which he wrote in 1964, a series of engagements with his mother's letters, which would have written to him in Yiddish. And he allows that the language of his mother's letters to invade his poetry in some way. And the poem articulates a lot of the sort of stakes or what's at stakes in this process of sort of meeting his mother's language in some way. So I'll read it again in Hebrew, and you can follow along in the English. Yom Yavo. Yom Yavo v'ish lo yukra mechtavim shel imi. Yesh li mehem chavila, lo shel mi ve'lo mila. Yom Yavo v'ish lo yukach otam. Yesh mehem tzror v'hoter. Yomru niyar pisat ve'lo yoter. ביום ההוא אביהם אל מערת בר כוכבה, לעלותם באבק. העולם הקודם לא יחקור בה, שפת אם. So this is a little bit harder, not as story driven, but what is this term Yom Yavo come from? It should remind us from the previous poem actually a little bit. What time signature are we in exactly? What's the reference in terms of Jewish time, do you think? Any suggestions?
Messianic?
What?
Messianic?
Yeah, messianic time. A day will come. But of course, as a good poet, he then deflates that same messianic time right afterwards. A day will come that no one will read these poems. So we're in a day of judgment, but a judgment that's a negative judgment, right? In which it's not a day in which someone will read my mother's letters and this woman and her past will come back to life. No, the opposite, a day will come in which it will be erased. And she and her letters and her language will be erased. Another important thing to note here from the beginning is how the Hebrew works, or what exactly Avot Yeshurun does to Hebrew, in which he kind of breaks it apart. So these lines, lo shel mi, that's not grammatically or idiomatically, it doesn't really work grammatically or idiomatically. It's not like saying it's not whose, it's not of who, would be sort of a very literal translation, lo shel mi. This is the third line, not anyone's. Or this line here, yomru niyar pisat. We're used to saying pisat niyar, a piece of paper. But he writes, a paper piece of. So there's already something that's in the act of reading or doing something with these letters. The language itself, Hebrew, starts falling apart in some way. Or one has to, in order to talk about this language that's falling apart or this legacy that's being not taken up, something has to happen to his Hebrew to go forward with it. It sort of has, the Hebrew itself has to, in some ways, fall apart. And then, so we have these letters that no one is going to read, that's sort of destroying this language. And on that day in which the language, the letters will no longer be taken up, Aviem, he's already, so we have Aviem, which is father, mother, but really I will bring them to Ma'arat Bar Kochva. Anyone know what Ma'arat Bar Kochva is?
Cave.
This was a famous discovery in near the Dead Sea, so sort of close to the Dead Sea Scrolls kind of thing. They found a cave in which there was writings by Bar Kochva. Bar Kochva, the famous rebel of the against the Romans.
Romans.
Yes, Romans. I got that right. Yes. After the destruction of the temple, all that stuff. So they finally found some of his writings, Israeli. Sorry, someone's speaking. Go ahead. Okay. So someone had found, you can look it up on Wikipedia. It's a nice long article about it in the Hebrew language. There's also a short one in English. I'm not an expert on archaeology of the state of Israel, but they'd found these writings that proved that Bar Kochva actually existed. They have, it's his name is spelled there Bar Kosima, but in some ways it was a big discovery that here was this hero of Hebrew or Jewish resistance. And it was very much important to that whole project of unearthing the Hebrew roots of the Hebrew land, right? These letters that he was writing from wherever he was hiding out up to the Galilee and other places like that. This was sort of like part of outlining and being able to substantiate that there was in fact a rebellion, which was very much in keeping with certain Zionist ideologies of armed conflict. So on that day, he's going to bring these letters to that cave. What does that mean? What's happening? Why would he bring them there? Any idea?
One possibility that strikes me is that the amazing thing about the Bar Kokhba letters is that they were preserved, you know, from like the year 120 CE until they were discovered after the Second World War. And so when I first saw this line, to cover them with dust, I thought, well, he's burying them and it's kind of depressing. Mm-hmm. But in a funny way, when you read it out, I was thinking, well, maybe he's thinking, well, they'll be preserved.
Certainly,
the way
yeah.
Bar Kokhba's letters were preserved. And maybe 2 millennia later, somebody is going to dig those letters up.
Yeah, there's something exciting here about this. Is
it not in the verb laha'alotam? Like
laha'alotam means
raising them up in some way?
So that's not exactly what the verb means, to like bring up dust to put on top of something. No, there's definitely burial going on, even though it feels, I guess, yeah, if you think about the verb is about elevating them in some way as well. So, right.
But it's preservation. It's preservation then.
Yeah. So it's preservation and gives them a status as holy objects, right? He's burying them as one would in a geniza, right? In some way. There's an act of making this very contemporary, very personal, very intimate set of documents into something ancient, primordial, foundational even. But of course, at the same time, knowing that no one is going to find them again. Right?
It's because, not functional in the world.
Yeah, it's not functionally more. Also, right, this cave has already been excavated. Right, those who wanted and needed something from that cave have gotten it and they're done with it. Right, no one is going to go back, this presumably, right, to go back to this cave to get these things. So it's a strange kind of, again, paradoxical motion of, here is this language that is foundational to me as a person, right? This is my mother tongue, my mother's tongue. And it's going to be forgotten, and I want to save it or preserve it in some way, but the only way I can do that is put into a place in which it will never be found.
But do you think it's relevant? This is Bethany Horowitz speaking. Do you think it's relevant that it's Bar Kokhba's cave, who's kind of a heroic figure, and burying this heroic past, you know, it's giving some heroic aura to the letters and to the people whose letters it was.
Exactly. Yeah. I absolutely agree. There's something he wants to think of these letters and his mother, or as exactly the kind of legends of his own life that he wants to upkeep, but also knowing that they will not be seized in any national way.
Are these letters in Hebrew or in Yiddish?
His mother's letters were in Yiddish.
My name's Elizabeth Colton. I just thought, when he says no one from Ha'olam HaKodem will discover them, it doesn't mean no one will discover them. It means I got the idea that it was mean in the future, maybe.
Right.
In the next world, someone will discover them.
That is the key word, ha'olam ha'kodem, and I'm not sure I know what that means. Because ha'kodem can also mean the ancient world, but also, you know, kidma is progress too. So the world to come, the world of progress, could also not want to take them up. So there's a kind of time problem contained in this verb, this phrase, ha'olam ha'kodem. It's both the ancient world will not take it up, right? It's not as if Bar Kokhba's world is going to come up again and take up these Yiddish letters, but also the world to come, the future of Israeli society, say, will not care about these letters. But then where do the letters live exactly? Of course, the answer, the meta answer to that question, is that the letters live in these poems, right? He's buried these letters in these poems, which are in Hebrew and which a lot of people read and a lot of people have read, right? So there's a way in which he's burying these letters, or burying Yiddish, in his own poetry. And what exactly does that do? It gives Hebrew actually a lot of authority and a lot of power. It also erases, right? It erases most of the letters, right? The only thing that's going to get into the letters are the small snippets that he does add into later poems. It's a long series of, say, like 20 poems. So he inserts certain words or certain phrases from his mother. But at the same time, it is preserving them, though covered in dust. So again, we're getting this image of a mourning of Yiddish in some way, but also and something that in some ways inspires or gives energy to the Hebrew language at the same time. Is this a fair judgment of what Hebrew does, both conserving and erasing at the same time? Must the divine language in this sense be so forgetful? I'm not so sure. So in the interest of time, because I only have 10 more minutes, let's get to the last poem, which I think will give us a good dialectical circle, but not necessarily give us any good answers. And that's a poem by Rivka Basman Ben Chaim, Aleha Sholom. She just passed away in March of 2023. she's born in Lithuania. She's a Holocaust survivor. She was in the Vilna ghetto. She made Aliyah in 1947 and lived in Israel for the rest of her life, a little bit on a kibbutz, but also in Herzliya Pituach. She's one of the most important Israeli Yiddish writers. She had a lot to say, being a Yiddish poet living in Israel, a lot to say about what it meant to write in Yiddish in the Hebrew land. And here's a poem that we'll read now to sort of tie things together. A really powerful poem, but I think also will ask a lot of the same questions we've already been getting at. It's called The Kinship Between Hebrew, between Yiddish and Hebrew. I'll read the Yiddish again. Die Kreuwenschaft zwischen Jiddisch und Ivrit, wie soll der klären? Efter wie tief es atmet Jiddisch rein in Hebräisch Wort, der warmt die Oisjes, schenkt sie ein Weicher in Trott. Und dann, wenn Jiddisch delzelt für Ivrit ihre Tränen, Tfilen bete Leschoines, dieselbige Tfile zu Gott. So another poem that plays with language and plays with the connection between, or the Hebrew within Yiddish or the Yiddish within Hebrew. Beginning with the very first word, kreuveshaft, karov is a relation, you know, your family member is your karov, and she gives that she uses a Hebrew word with a Germanic ending, kreuveshaft, so kinship, is a word that is both Hebraic and Germanic at the same time. And she too uses the word Ivrit and not Hebraish. So again, referring to a kinship between Yiddish and modern Israeli Hebrew. And she's trying to figure out how to explain that connection, how to work on it, or how exactly it works. She divides that into two parts, what Yiddish does for Hebrew and what Hebrew does for Yiddish. So this first one we have, Yiddish breathing something deep into a Hebrew word, warming the letters, giving them a soft step. Based on what we've already discussed in the first two poems, what do you think this is? How does Yiddish give Hebrew a soft step? How does Yiddish warm up its letters?
Yiddish has sibilants and modern Hebrew doesn't, the way it's spoken in Israel now.
So can you explain a little bit what you mean by sibilants?
Softness.
So just based on some of the way vowels work in Hebrew, I guess you could say Hebrew is a little bit harsher than Yiddish at times. Go ahead. There's another hand somewhere.
Yeah, this is Mike Showklapper. I think that Yiddish has usually the words and the language has more than one meaning, so it does give it a multiple meanings rather than one simple meaning.
Yes. No. We feel bad for the Hebraists because they have a very poor language. Hebrew has a very limited vocabulary, and they had to invent tons of words. And so it doesn't have the same range of semantic meanings to all the words. More and more now, of course, as Hebrew becomes an older language with a longer cultural history and series of dialects and idiolects associated with different populations, different regions, and different all kinds of things. So I don't mean to put down Hebrew, but compared to a language like English, you know, with you don't need much of a thesaurus in Hebrew, because there's only one. I mean, there's lots of words for rain because the Bible was good about that. But all the other things, you know, Hebraists have to all the time invent things when they don't know what to do with something. And sometimes those inventions work, like Pelephone, which is a great invention, the wonder phone, whereas other things don't, you know, don't work as well. But no, don't mean to put down Hebrew again. I don't want to, you know, display my colors too much here. But the sense here is that, again, like we talked about before, the feeling or the semantic structures of Hebrew come from Yiddish in this claim, right? That manishma is actually a vos herzich. The feeling behind it is a vos herzich, what lives behind it, right? That is what Yiddish is giving to Hebrew, giving of itself, literally inserting itself into Hebrew by giving it this, warming its actually cold letters, right? So think of this idea of Hebrew as a language of text, right? A dead language that needs to be given life. Its letters literally need to be warmed up because it is a dead, or it supposedly was a dead language, and Yiddish is the language that gives it that.
Yeah, I saw David Getzelman had a hand up.
Go ahead, David. Yeah.
Is it significant that here it's not saying Ivrit, it's saying Hebraish word? That which would mean, to my mind, that wouldn't mean what Yiddish is doing to modern Hebrew, but what Yiddish does to the Hebrew that's in Yiddish.
Or or what Yiddish does to the Hebrew within Hebrew, to think about it sort of like in more dimensions, right? Like we said before, memele doesn't mean the same thing in modern Israeli Hebrew without Yiddish, right? So that Yiddish gives Ivrit its Hebraish.
But I'm thinking of something like mi'et la'et is a harder sounding expression than nestless, you know?
Nestless, right. If you were to say me'et le'et, which means 24 hours, in contemporary Israeli Hebrew, someone would think that you were either pompous or trying to show off your learnedness, right? Meisles, if you say that in Yiddish, that's just how you say 24 hours.
Right, and it's softer.
It also is softer, yes. The tests.
Because when I think of the expression Hebraish, I think of Hebrew words used in the Yiddish language and often transformed a little bit in mm-hmm. to work in Yiddish.
Yes, like the word efsher in Yiddish means right.
perhaps,
whereas efshar in Hebrew means it's possible. And right. those are very, very yeah. separate things.
Nava Harlow had a hand up.
Go ahead.
Just, I reacted to the word warming the letters and giving them a soft step. And I'm thinking about Mama Lushan. And mm-hmm. it's the comfort and the warmth of the language of our Mama Lushan that brings that special lack. What's lacking in Hebrew, the Mama Lushan can contribute and make it more.
Yes, special. I agree. So there's also a gender component here associated with warmth is a kind of mothering that comes out of, again, the Svat Em, the mother tongue.
Yes.
And then we get this second stanza in which strange things happen. So then Yiddish is presenting itself in front of Hebrew, presenting to Hebrew its tears. So this we will immediately associate with the tears we associate with the Yiddish past. So that would be the Holocaust, the suffering, the decline of Yiddish, decline of Yiddish speakers, the decline of Eastern Europe as a place and as a cultural construct. And somehow that act of telling one's sorrows or one's woes to Ivrit, to this Israeli, the strong Israeli Hebrew, tfilin beit lashon es dizelbe ketfile zu Gott. Now, the verb tfilin, to pray, that is a neologism. In Yiddish, you don't usually say tfilin, you say davenin or mispalel zayin. This is making out of the word, it would be like saying prayering. The two languages prayer together, the same prayer. It's something she kind of takes from another Yiddish poet, Avram Sutzkever, who does this all the time. but it's sort of, there's a kind of excess of praying that's happening to God through this moment of connection. So when Yiddish gives Hebrew its Hebraish, or gives it its softness, Hebrew in turn becomes a language of prayer. And that's something other than the allowing Yiddish to speak or sing underneath the Yiddish that we had, underneath the Hebrew that we had in the first poem. It's something other than mourning that takes place, or a Hebrew covering up, or a Hebrew containment of Yiddish in the second poem. Instead, we get the two languages together praying. In some sense, one of the things that Basman Ben Chaim is doing here is that Yiddish allows Hebrew in some way to become a liturgical language again, which is strange to think of, because we think of Hebrew as the liturgical language and Yiddish as the vernacular. But there's something that happens in the combination of the two, or the meeting of the two, in which one language encounters the history of the other, or the experiences of the other, that they're allowed to pray. And again, this is a vernacular prayer. So think of vernacular prayers in Yiddish, something called a trine, which were prayers mostly made by women in Yiddish, not in Hebrew. This kind of giving a liturgical power to a vernacular past in a way that undoes some of the strictures, some of the hardness, some of the coldness of the Hebrew language, as Basman Ben Chaim portrays it. So you get a rather strange thing, a language of coexistence, of family, of community, adjoining together in prayer, despite the different fates of the language. And it's not entirely clear how that happens, but there's something that happens in that moment of identification. So just to sum up, because I know we're out of time, and I just want to give us a kind of mapping so that it sits in your brain in some way. We've had three different models that we've kind of looked at. One, where there's an eternal gap, a parodic gap between Hebrew and Yiddish, and there's Hebrew is kind of foolish and silly, but there's a kind of messianic vision for Hebrew in the future, or a kind of return to Yiddish that would enliven Hebrew, according to Glotzstein. The second, we have a forgotten past that is being buried, but also at the same time contained or saved within a Hebrew poetic idiom. And the third one, we have Yiddish and Hebrew as coexistence, Yiddish providing Hebrew with life, with softness, and they're participating together in a new kind of divine worship. An older and more fundamental Hebrew comes back to life through Yiddish. And what we have here is I think the way I presented it is kind of artificial in this way, but a kind of shaky dialectic, what we might call, according to Allen, an arc toward the deep structure of Jewish civilization. So we move from Glotzstein's grievance against Hebrew to Avot Yeshurun's mourning of Yiddish to Basman Ben Chaim's reconciliation between the two, right? If out of the three, our last poem is the most optimistic, right? And notice also that in each poem, we have religious vocabulary, right? And in the first poem, we have Glotzstein saying, Svet kumene zeit, a time will come. And we have that same phrase in the second poem, Bayom hahu, yom yavo, and in Basman Chaim's prayer. So that the coming together of these languages brings us to some kind of moment of mystical or some kind of spiritual redemption that could happen in the meeting of these two languages. As if Yiddish invites Hebrew to return to its mythical functions, or Hebrew reminds Yiddish of its holy purpose. All of this contained within the secular form of the lyric poem, in which you have a kind of meeting of the vernacular and the divine. And I like that idea of meeting of the vernacular and divine, because what is prayer if not a meeting of the everyday and the most theologically grand, right? And what I like to think of this as, sort of also following some of the ways I've thought about Allen, the way he invites people to scholarship, there's also here an invitation in each of these poems, or in these poems together, to what I would call, for my own purposes, a kind of faithless prayer. No matter what we're doing, or what we're mourning, or what we think we've lost, right? We still pray nonetheless, right? One can do nothing but, as if you speak Yiddish or if you speak Hebrew, you're already praying, whether you want to or not. And that's where I'll leave it for this. What about Hebrew? What does Hebrew do? One of the things it does is through Yiddish or with Yiddish, bring us to this moment of faithless prayer. And I'll end there and leave it to the rest of you for now.
Thank you so much, Saul. That was really, really terrific. And so much honored Alan's memory and in the spirit of his work and his career and indeed his entire life. So thank you. Delightful. We want to leave some time for people to share some reflections about Alan. I'm going to hand the chair of this chairing, what's the word, hosting, the hosting, over to Amira Mintz-Morgenthau, who will take on these duties. But I'm going to jump in first because I have something to read, a reflection about Alan. And that is, I got an email the other day from a member of Minyan Ma'at, Ann Mintz. Ann is not related to Alan. And she's in LA this week, and she, because of various commitments out there, she couldn't be on this study session, which she would very much like to have been able to. But she wrote a reflection about Alan, which is a kind of funny reflection that I thought was quite cute about her connection to him. So I'm going to read this, and then Amira, you can call on other people and we can have other volunteers. So here's what she wrote. As many of you know, I have an older brother named Alan Mintz, spelled the same way as A-L-A-N. When we were children living in Rochester, New York, the Chazan was the executive director of the Cantor's Assembly and saw every bulletin from a conservative synagogue. At one point, shortly after my brother's bar mitzvah, probably in early 1959, he took my parents aside during Kiddush and showed them the one from Worcester, Massachusetts, with the announcement of the upcoming bar mitzvah of an Alan Mintz. We had a good laugh. Fast forward to the summer of 1964 at Camp Ramah in Connecticut, and then she puts in parentheses, and Barry Holtz was my waiter. This is my great claim to fame, according to Ann Mintz. And my brother was on staff, having spent the previous summer at Camp Ramah in the Poconos. Our Eda had a trip to New York City, and we stopped at Camp Ramah in Nyack, where the American Seminar was, to have lunch and perform a play. During lunch, some of the Nyack guys were hanging out with us and heard my name. One asked if I was related to Alan Mintz, and I said, yes, he's my brother, assuming the kid knew him from the Poconos the previous summer. A few minutes later, he came back and he said, he says he doesn't have a sister, only a brother. I had no idea what he meant. He pointed to Alan, our Alan Mintz, at a nearby table, and I went over to introduce myself. Whereas I had known of his existence, he did not know of my brother's until that day. I told him about that synagogue bulletin. We saw each other on and off over the next few years with USY and Ramah, and each of us wound up settling on the Upper West Side. For more than 50 years, I was truly delighted that our lives continued to intersect, although it did get tiring being asked if I was related to Alan Mintz.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Barry. I may or may not have heard that story before. Every single time I laugh and appreciate it. So thanks, Anne, for sharing that. And I just wanted to just like preface with, I know that so many of you knew Alan in different ways, had different relationships with him. Some have known him, you know, such as Barry, since, you know, you were both, you know, 14 or so, and knew him from, you know, camp and so on. And I'd love, you know, for, you know, it's so helpful, I think, for me to keep his memory alive by hearing these stories and these memories. So with that, I know, Anne, you had your hand raised. Sure. Did you want to share something?
You know, I just wanted to thank Saul and say how much I enjoyed this. And it really made me think about Alan's choice of modern Hebrew literature as his field of study. I mean, that happened before I met him, before we worked together on Agnon. But I know that he was drawn to the Piyut, he was drawn to medieval studies, and chose modern Hebrew for the richness of the cultural mix and the classical sources. So Saul, I want to say that I enjoyed your teaching so much in your demonstration of how Yiddish inhabits Hebrew as that's enacted in these various poems. And it just felt it was a very intimate mix of languages and felt like a further extension of the work that Alan was drawn to do.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I said I had just chatted Saul and, you know, directly, but I completely agree. I think that Alan had this way of making his teaching so accessible to folks. And I really felt that with the way that you taught this. So thank you. I know that Sophia had something to share. Would you like to go ahead?
Sure, I can. And first of all, would also like to echo what others have said. Saul, that was really just beautiful. And thank you so much for sharing your teaching with us and those beautiful poems. So a thing I think about often with Al, I knew Alan my entire life. I don't think there was a period of time in my life where Alan was not a part of it, because Amira and I have been friends for so long and our families have been close for so long. And a thing I think about often with Alan, in addition to, of course, the things we know, his love of cooking, I'm pretty sure he's the person who introduced me to not only risotto, but beets, which are forbidden in our house, but he was a great lover of. But a thing I think about often with Alan is his sense of humor and how dry and like subtle that sense of humor was, but also like just like excellent zingers, which I sadly don't have examples of. But a thing I think about with Alan all the time is he used to drive Amira, Avital, and I to these art classes we were taking in Yonkers, and we would all kind of pile into that green minivan, and Alan would drive, and we would be talking about whatever in the back seat, and whoever was in the front seat would be sitting with Alan, and Alan always would put on Wait, Don't Tell Me, because it was exactly the time of day when that show was on. And I gotta say, as a preteen, a lot of the jokes on Wait, Don't Tell Me would just go straight over my head. And I remember the three of us and whoever else was in the van on a given Sunday would complain and say, Alan, like, can we please put on like music or anything else? And he'd be like, no, this is the time for Wait, Don't Tell Me. And we would kind of just like, you know, sit there, and he would just, he had this wonderful chuckle, and we'd be like talking about whatever we'd be talking about, and he'd be listening to the radio and just really having a good time, even though I'm sure we were quite annoying in the back seat. So I think about Alan a lot because Wait, Don't Tell Me is now a thing I listen to on my own. And I gotta say, every time I hear it, it's the primary association I have is with Alan. So I know that's a small story and not of weighty significance, but it is a thing I think about often, and I miss him a lot.
Sophia, I was just telling Tamir about Wait, Don't Tell Me. And I feel like that's probably where I got most of my current events from on that Sunday. I'd be like, can someone explain that joke to me? I don't read the news when you're in middle school and high school. And then I also think that those zingers probably shouldn't be repeated because, you know, anyone who heard them, they're probably not meant for everyone. And I was thinking about what I wanted to share today, and something that a memory that I was thinking of recently was a memory from when I was much younger, like 5, 6 years old. I had these horrible growing pains in my legs, and I would wake up in the middle of the night every night with so much pain. And I would wake up my dad in the middle of the night, like almost every other night for a few years. And he would like put water in the bath. It was the only thing that helped me. I'd get in the bath and then he'd sit on the toilet. I mean, he'd just like sit on top of the toilet and read me a book. And I mean, it was probably like 2 hours every night for a few years of our life. And I was thinking, I was recently talking to, I'm like in my medical training right now. And I was recently talking to one of my attendings and just talking about how frustrating it is with patients where I feel like I can't do anything for them, or I don't have any answers to give them or any treatments to give them. And he said, you know, sometimes there isn't, and like all you can really do is offer your presence and your comfort. And I feel like my dad, you know, often didn't have like the perfect thing to say, but he always was present and always offered his comfort. So something I thought about recently.
Art, go ahead.
Hi, everyone. As I say, it's wonderful to see old friends and old faces. I know Aaron almost from when Barry knows Aaron. I think he was 14 or 15 when I met him. The most vivid memory I have is his coming to me to ask me whether I thought he should run for USY president, for national president of USY, and a long conversation about that. I counseled him against it, and he went ahead and did it. He was too much of a budding intellectual for it, I thought. I didn't know how he would put up with all that loud rah-rah singing and cutlery banging and all that noise. He was somehow a serious kid already at that point, and really looking for something deeper in his Judaism. He was one of those kids from Worcester. Worcester, there was a very special group of kids from Worcester, so I don't know exactly how much younger you are. But Aaron, there were a group of kids a year or two behind Aaron, Bernie Rotman, a kid by the name of Marty Snyder, because the Worcester kids had the worst Boston accents you could imagine. Aaron was a little more sophisticated. He didn't talk like that. But they were all influenced by Baruch Goldstein, whose name I want to mention here. Aaron was at Beth Israel before Baruch came there. But he was very much, very impressed by Baruch. Baruch was a Holocaust survivor. He was the son-in-law of Rabbi Galinkin, who was the Orthodox rabbi at Worcester, and came there and was a Holocaust survivor from the yeshiva world, who knew Yiddishkeit in every way inside out, meaning Gemara and Yiddish and Hebrew. He was also a person of very grave doubts after the Holocaust. He wrote a wonderful memoir, which I recommend to you. And as I was working with USY kids from around New England, we were running USY summer encampments, and I met all the kids who were active in the movement. This is when I was a rabbinical student. The Worcester kids always had something a little bit more serious about them, a little deeper love of Yiddishkeit. And that was largely attributable to Baruch's influence, I thought. He ran the Hebrew High School at Beth Israel for a while, and then, of course, he became the rabbi there. But Aaron was certainly the most serious of them. And he had a kind of sense that there was something special about the Worcester community. I think he was the one who told me that they used to call Worcester Yerushalayim to Massachusetts, sort of in the generation before his, because there was a bunch of Hebraists and learned people there. And Aaron is certainly the leading example of that, and the person who most embodied that tradition. Maybe, Saul, you're the same figure in the next generation. But it's very nice to remember him that way in the context of the place he came from. And what an incredible contribution, of course, he came to make. So Yizikro Baruch, good to be with everybody and remember him together.
Thank you for sharing that. Is there anyone else that would like to speak? Eric.
Hi, how's everyone? I have a, first of all, Alan and I first met actually the summer after and met Barry at Campermont in Connecticut. I was a kitchen boy with Barry in the summer of 65, was it, Barry? I can't remember now, 66, I guess. And that following year, I came to New York to visit some friends of mine. And one of the other kitchen boys who worked with me and Barry was Arthur Rubin. We called him Rubes. You couldn't imagine a greater contrast between Art and Arthur and your dad. Art was not exact. Well, let's put it this way. Art's main literary contribution, as I recall, was the ability to sing House of the Rising Sun backwards. That was Art. However, fast forward a number of years later, and I was now living in New York, and Barry and Alan and I, on a fairly regular basis, would go together to the movie theater to see what we called boys' movies. These were movies that had absolutely no redeeming social or literary value, but we enjoyed seeing them together. And one of the endearing parts of Alan, which I'll always remember very fondly, was that after we would come out of the movie theater, having seen a movie that truly was pure dreck, Alan would invariably have a very detailed literary analysis of what we watched. And I was in amazement. What can I say? It reflected his piercing intellect and the ability to find good things and even dreck, as I said. So
It's Carol Engel, and I want to add a little something about the Baruch Goldstein relationship. I was living in Providence, and at the time, Baruch Goldstein, Rabbi Baruch Goldstein, had retired and lived in Providence. So I felt like a character in some kind of Shakespearean play, sending letters back and forth from the two of them, and regards from the two of them. And ultimately, Alan wrote a book, and he dedicated it to Baruch Goldstein. Well, Amira and Avital probably know the story, that people went bonkers when they saw that Alan Mintz was dedicating a book to somebody who sponsored murders in Israel, because you remember that the fellow who went and killed people said that he was Baruch Goldstein. And it was clear that that was not the same Baruch Goldstein.
I definitely remember that story and was thinking about it as Art was telling the story about dedicating his book to Baruch Goldstein.
I think Marge had her hand up.
Oh, okay. Marge, please.
You have to unmute yourself, Marge. There you go.
It's the Worcester connection again. When I first moved from Minneapolis back to New York, a friend said, you should check out Minyan Ma'at. And I came to Minyan Ma'at. There was one sort of familiar face, but I didn't know anyone else. Soon after, I learned that Alan was from Worcester, where my mother grew up. And where my family grew up. And I told this, my uncle was still alive, and I mentioned it to him. And he told me that he had gone to the South when he, after he graduated high school, because that was the least expensive education was available there. And he settled in Atlanta, but he took his Atlanta bride back to Worcester once. And he looked up only one old friend whom we grew up with, and that was Nelson Mintz. Alan's father, I think that was his name. And then I learned that my aunt, the mother of Amy Zarrow, an Anche Chesed member, I think my aunt and Alan's mother lived in the same community after they'd left their houses. So there's more and more Worcester connections.
Hi, this is Michael Fried. Good evening. And I'd like to thank Saul very much for your very moving presentation. And the poetry is very evocative. My own perspective is perhaps different from many of you who are, of us who are gathered here, in that I came to JTS somewhat recently as a doctoral student. And the first course that I took there in 2016 in the fall was taught by Alan Nucho Eden on the poetry of Chaim Nachman Bialik. And the other course I was taking, incidentally, was on biblical Hebrew grammar with Stephen Geller, but that's another story. Alan, I came to understand that there was an ideological, a central principle at work in his decision to conduct the entire class in Hebrew during the semester. Lectures, questions, answers, as has been pointed out, he felt very deeply that knowledge of Hebrew and currency with Hebrew and actually love for the Hebrew language is a central Jewish value that is important to maintain. And if I may, in just a minute, I'd like to read in Alan's beloved memory a few verses from a poem by Bialik that we were instructed to memorize and recite at his office one by one as part of our requirements for the course, in addition to writing two papers and having a couple of exams. I'll read just a few verses, not the whole thing, in Hebrew, in Bialik's, and Bialik significantly as being a seminal figure in Hebrew literature, who continued to write in the Ashkenazic pronunciation and meter of Hebrew. For his time, but who also, with another scholar, Rav Nitzky, compiled Sefer HaAgadah and did a great work on bringing forward the poetry of such luminaries from the Middle Ages as Shlomo Ibn Gabirol. This poem is called Livadi. And then I'll read an English translation of these verses. Kulam nasa haruach. Kulam sacha fa'oyer, shira chadasha, es boiger chayehem hirnina, va'ani goizel rach, nishtekachti mi lev, tachas kanfei hashchina. Badad, badad, nisharti, v'hashchina af hi, kanaf yamina hashvura, al roshi hira'ida. Yada libi, es liba, Harod Harda alai al bana al yehida. Var nitgar sha, mikol hazvios
Rak oid pina seiter shoymeima uktana nishara. Beis ha-midrash. Betiskach betzel ve'ahi imach yachad betzara. Alone, all gone with the wind, all swept away by the light, a new song filled with song the morning of their lives. And I, a tender chick, was quite forgot, alone under the wing of the divine presence. Alone, alone I remained, and the divine presence herself shook her broken right wing over my head. My heart knew her heart. She feared for me, her son, her only one. Already driven from all corners, only one hidden, empty, small spot remained, the prayer house. And she hid in the shadow, and I was with her in her distress. And when my heart drew to the window toward the light, and the place grew small for me beneath her wing, she hid her head in my neck, and her tear dropped on my page of Gemara. So I'd just like to express how deeply I was affected by Alan's gentleness, his rigorous scholarship, and his friendship, and his inspirational devotion to the Hebrew language.
Thank you, Michael. Is there anyone else? If not, I think we will close. Thank you so, so much, everyone, for being here. This was a really special session. Again, thank you so much, Saul. Thank you, Barry, for organizing the session and this whole evening. Thank you, Bonnie, for, you know, doing all of the Minyan tech. What were you called? A tech? I don't remember what it was called.
My friend called me a Zoom Gabbai.
A Zoom Gabbai. Thank you. And everyone else for being here. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you all.
Memory be a blessing.
Blessing. Yes. Amen. Yes. So long ago.
Good night. Thanks.
Bye.
Toda and gedank.